I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. How does a combat veteran cope with terrible wounds and scars that never disappear? Our guest this hour was just 13 days from the end of his tour in Vietnam when a landmine ended life as he knew it. Marine Lieutenant Robert Timberg suffered third-degree burns that required 35 painful operations and left him disfigured for life. He could have fallen into terminal despair, but instead launched a new and challenging career as a newspaper reporter. He learned to deal with reactions to his scarred face and to a changed country that often made villains of those who served. His long and difficult climb back brought him to the top ranks of American journalism and acclaim for 3 books of nonfiction. But it cost him 2 marriages. Bob Timberg recounts his journey in an unsparing memoir called Blue-Eyed Boy. He joins me next on Midday. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. We often hear about the problems that wounded veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan have dealing with their physical and psychological injuries. In fact, we've spent quite a bit of time talking about that here on our show. And no one knows this better than our guest in this hour. He's been dealing with his scars for 47 years. Marine Lieutenant Robert Timberg was just 13 days from returning home from Vietnam. He and his wife had been married 6 months when he shipped out in 1966, part of a military buildup in an escalating war that would eventually split the country. Bob Timberg saw the war as his duty. He was among the last of a generation who believed in their government and in the military. He won an appointment to the Naval Academy and took his commission in the Marines. He was atop a military vehicle, an amphibian tractor, an Amtrak, when it struck a landmine in Vietnam. The resulting fireball left Bob Timberg with third-degree burns over his face and arms. He survived 35 painful operations over the next few years, one without an anesthetic. Despite the best efforts of a talented plastic surgeon, Bob's face was still scarred and unrecognizable to people who had known him. And he had to decide what to do with his life. Although he'd never published a word and avoided strangers because of their reaction to his appearance, Bob Timberg chose journalism, reporting, writing. At Stanford's graduate school, he not only learned his craft, but he also learned how to deal with a population whose attitudes toward war and military service had turned 180 degrees. Like many Vietnam vets, he felt angry and resentful about that. But he resolved to get on with his life and talked his way into a job at the Annapolis Capitol, where he excelled from the start. He came back to Annapolis. And from there, he went to the Baltimore Evening Sun. He covered City Hall, the State House, and went to the paper's Washington Bureau. He won a prestigious Nieman Fellowship to Harvard. He came back to Baltimore, went to the White House, covered the White House for the Baltimore Sun. His coverage of the Iran-Contra scandal in the Reagan years led to his first book, the acclaimed The Nightingale's Song. He's written 2 books since then. Bob Timberg's new memoir is intense, personal, and unsparingly self-critical. Like many other vets with terrible physical and psychological scars, Bob Timberg found a way to survive. Besides The Nightingale's Song, Bob Timberg is the author of John McCain, An American Odyssey. The last time he joined us here on Midday was to discuss that book and the life of John McCain. And State of Grace, a memoir of twilight time. The latest book is Blue-Eyed Boy, a memoir, and it's available from the Penguin Press. So, Bob, it's always good to have you visit here at Midday. This is our third time together here on the radio, and it's just great to see you, and congratulations on this really terrific memoir.
Thank you, Dan. It's always my pleasure.
Gives me an opportunity to ask you questions I've always wanted to ask you.
And makes it impossible for me to dodge questions I never wanted to hear.
Yeah, right? You're kind of trapped here in Studio A. But what, writing a memoir, putting yourself out there. And So I've always wanted to ask you, and I've known you all these years, known you since the mid-70s when I went to work at the Evening Sun. And you were top dog political reporter, who I quickly came to admire because of your work ethic. Why did you go to the Naval Academy? I knew you grew up in New York City and had a pretty interesting life as a teenager. And I read a lot about your life there in Sandlot Football in the earlier book. But I always wanted to ask you, what drew you to the Naval Academy in Annapolis?
Well, I would like to say that it was there was a noble calling, and it was half that. I did feel a desire to serve my country. There was also a desire to get away from my family. And, you know, and I had two younger sisters, and I had a mother who had been a Ziegfeld girl and beautiful, but had become an alcoholic. And I had my dad, who was a wonderful musician, composer, but seemed to me to be timid. Something, I don't know why I had a problem with timid people, but I did when it was my dad. But I mean, I wanted to get away. I wanted to go to a college that took me out of the house. And see, if getting me out of the house meant I couldn't be around to sort of basically keep watch for my sisters. And I just didn't have it in me to go off to some school like any civilian school.
Right.
I just didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, because I had a school right down the street. I had St. John's University. So I went to St. John's for a year but I wanted to go to the Naval Academy, I say, because I did have a desire to serve. But it also was the kind of place that there was nothing else like it. I couldn't say, well, all right, I'm going to go here. And guess what? There's no other possibility. If I want to be a naval officer or a marine officer, this is where I go. And so it was kind of self-serving.
Where did that desire to be in the military come from? The idea of becoming a marine?
Well, the desire to be in the military was, I don't know where it came from. The desire to become a Marine was something that grew on me at the academy, because I had always, for reasons that I've never quite sorted out, always felt that given a choice, I had to take the toughest option. And Marines seemed tougher than the Navy. I'm not really sure that's true, but it did seem that way. And so I did it. That's what I did. I also felt that the Marine Corps gave me a greater chance to command troops faster than the Navy.
This was the late 50s, early 60s when you were making this decision. In your class at the Naval Academy in Annapolis was 1964?
Yes, right? Absolutely.
Right. So this is a different time, and sometimes
we're having our 50th reunion this year.
Yeah, I get that. Yeah. So, you know, I asked that question, what drew you to the Naval Academy, or what would draw someone to West Point or to the military generally, and this sounds like a post-Vietnam, post-Iraq, post-Afghanistan question, you know, but it's not. I really always wondered what had drawn you there. Some of us grew up with uncles talking about World War II and Korea, and lots of conversation about military, photographs of uncles and our fathers in military uniforms. That wasn't your experience.
No, it wasn't. I had lots of...
Your father was a vaudevillian, right?
Yeah, and he was much too old to be in the service. But mm-hmm. I had cousins and uncles, and just one was in the Army. He served in the Army. He served in the Philippines.
The other thing I wanted to always ask you about was your service in Vietnam and what happened, you know, and that's what this memoir is, Blue Eyed Boy. And so before I get to that, I ask you this question, because the three books that you wrote previous to this, I'm a fan of these books, and they're nonfiction, excellent reporting, and very strong writing. And I'm not saying that because you're an old friend of mine. I'm not blowing smoke.
Dan, and I'm not saying that because you're an old friend of mine.
But Nightingale's Song, I mean, it was widely acclaimed. It's just a terrific book. But you spent your life writing about other people, right? You're a reporter, and you weren't a columnist, and columnists get to indulge the first person once in a while.
Yeah.
I don't remember you doing hardly any of that in the Baltimore Sun years.
No.
And then the books you wrote after that weren't about you. Well, Saving Grace was a
State
little
of
bit.
Grace,
State of,
of
Grace
yeah.
was, I mean, a little bit. So you're getting used to the idea of a memoir maybe with that book.
Yeah, and some people have subsequently said they saw State of Grace as a prequel to this book.
Right, you know. Right. It really does describe.
But I certainly wasn't thinking about writing this book when I was writing State of Grace.
Well, what I appreciate about that was the way it described sort of my older brother's generation and attitude pre-Vietnam, before everybody got disillusioned and muddle-headed about what our mission in the world was.
Right.
Right. So and then we get to Vietnam, and the incident, I guess we should talk about, the explosion, the mine that changed your life. The one thing I didn't know is you had told me years ago, I thought you said you were on top of a truck. And it wasn't really a truck. It was a vehicle called an amphibian tractor, an Amtrak.
Amtrak, right.
And I wanted to take a moment here to set this up a little bit. Describe what that is and what you were doing on that day.
Well, this is a story that maybe only I love, and I, in a way, kind of hate it too. But first of all, an Amtrak is it was similar to an armored personnel carrier, which is what the Army had, tracked vehicles carrying people. The Marine Corps did not have anything like that. What they had instead was an Amtrak, which was, in a way, an armored personnel carrier, but it also was amphibious for ship-to-shore movement. Well, at any rate, there was space inside to ride in these vehicles, and nobody rode inside because if you hit a mine and ignited the fuel, you were, you know, fricasseed.
12 cells, 456 gallons of gasoline.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, right. Yeah, a lot of gasoline.
Right,
more than enough.
Right. Right. So rather than being inside, maybe you hung on the sides or you sat on top. Right?
Yeah, and I was sitting on top. I wasn't supposed to be there that day. As you mentioned earlier, I had 13 days left, and I was preparing to go to either Okinawa or Tokyo on R&R and, you know, look for stereo equipment.
Right, because you had a wife back in California.
Yeah.
You were hoping to return home and bring a Teak or Sony stereo
absolutely.
To your house, to
absolutely.
Your apartment. To your
absolutely.
Apartment.
Right. And you know, maybe get my wife some pearls or something. And well, so that was my plan. I mean, this is my tour was effectively over. But the other side of the coin is that the Marine Corps always pays the troops. And if they can, if it's possible to pay them, you pay them.
No matter where they are
yes,
at the time,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And so you got payroll duty. You were executive officer of your unit.
Yeah,
right?
I wasn't supposed to be the. We took turns. The officers in the company took turns as pay officers. And, you know, you went out and you paid the guys. Well, the guy who was supposed to be, the lieutenant who was supposed to be pay officer, got involved in something that had to do with the war. So, and I said, hey Bob, you got it. You're pay officer now. And it wasn't like I couldn't say anything. It wasn't an excuse. He probably would rather have been a pay officer than what he had to do, you know. But I became pay officer, and that's how I wound up on top of that Amtrak on that day.
The Amtrak was set off to find this other unit so
you
could pay
them,
right?
Right, we were going to another platoon to pay them. I had this little canvas bag of military script in it, which looked like dollar bills, except you didn't have Old Hickory or Honest Abe or any of those guys on it. You had a woman's face who, I swear to God, reminded me of Jackie Kennedy.
How strange.
It was strange.
So you were on top of this Amtrak. I'm just going to read an excerpt from your book here because we have to take a little break, and then we'll continue the story. But I thought I would read this part of it. So you have the payroll duty, and you're not that happy about it, but what are you going to do? You're on the Amtrak, and you're headed off to find this other unit to pay these guys. You said you weren't fixating on your grievance, right, on that particular moment, focusing on a personal grievance while moving through hostile territory, which meant every piece of land except the one you were standing on was a luxury only an immortal could afford. From the top of the Amtrak, my eyes constantly scanned the terrain, the desolate open area to the right, the tree line to the left, the uncomfortably well-worn trail our tracks were rolling over. The ground was pitted with craters large and small, evidence of exploded mortars and artillery rounds and mines. But for weeks, the trail had been used to resupply troops in the bush without incident, so we were cautious and alert, but we did not anticipate trouble. Moments later, I felt myself lifted from the top of the Amtrak, as if in the eye of a hurricane, except in place of wind and rain, I was being carried aloft by flames. It's an excerpt from Blue-Eyed Boy, a memoir by our guest in this hour of midday, Bob Timberg. A short break. We'll come back and talk some more. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm speaking with an old friend of mine, Robert Timberg, longtime reporter, White House correspondent, and editor at the Sun Papers. His new memoir is called Blue-Eyed Boy, a frank, fascinating, and often painful story about his recovery from terrible, disfiguring burns he suffered in Vietnam when the vehicle that we were just describing before the break hit a landmine. So that moment where you end a chapter, that excerpt actually ends one of the chapters and continues now with the story. Another question I've always wanted to ask you, you know, what it's like to sit on top of a gigantic mass of steel that blows up. You describe it in the book as like a hurricane that's throws you up into the air, and then you land on the ground, and you're still, for a time, you're unconscious, but then you sort of come around. You hear the voice of one of your colleagues yelling to you to wake up, Lieutenant.
Right? Yeah, this was the basic infantry tactics say, if you do something like set a landmine, that's going to cause your enemy to get all discombobulated and disorganized. You try and stay real close, and when they're running around like chickens with their heads cut off, you kill them all. Right?
And this landmine, you might have, the Amtrak might have gone over the landmine, but it also might have been set off by.
Yeah, I think it was probably set off by, I think it was what they call a command detonated mine. Somebody in the trees, Viet Cong in the trees, just pushed a plunger or something, and there it went. But, you know, when I was knocked out. I wound up lying on the ground, and I don't know how long I was out, but I don't think very long, because I had a platoon sergeant was over me saying, "Hey, Lieutenant, wake up, you okay?" And I came to, and I said, "Hey, Sergeant, we've got to get a perimeter defense out," which meant, you know, the bad guys are going to be coming at us, so let's get something out there, either warn them off or be able to protect ourselves.
So you actually were giving an order from your prone position, having been injured, and you actually don't know what's happened to you yet.
No, right? No. I knew I'd been wounded, but I didn't know how badly. And and the sergeant said, "Lieutenant, I already did that." He already put out the... So that was actually probably the last serious order I ever gave. Mm-hmm. And it was unnecessary. I mean, you never, never, never can underestimate either the ingenuity or the skill of enlisted Marines.
Bob, I get the impression from your writing, your description of this day and that moment, that you didn't actually feel the pain right away.
Yeah, you're right. I didn't. I started feeling a little pain while I was lying there. I knew something had happened, and I think I knew I had been burned, but I didn't have a sense that this was really that serious. And then it started to hurt. And a corpsman came up and said, "Hey, Lieutenant, is this hurting? Are you hurting?" I said, "Well, yeah, starting to hurt, corpsman." And he said, "Well, I can't give you any morphine because you have a head wound, so you'll just have to wait till the choppers come in and they get you back to the base hospital or something." So that's what I did. And but man, those Marines were like, they were really, really efficient. I mean, nobody came at us, and I knew there were bad guys in the trees. And then the chopper came in, and suddenly people are picking me up and carrying me to the chopper helicopter, and before I knew it, you know, 10, 20 minutes, we were back at the base hospital at Da Nang. base hospital, you know, not to overdo the sense of grandeur here. This was tents.
Right. This bunch of tents. I meant to say that this happened outside of Da Nang.
Yes.
You were stationed there.
Yes.
Was anyone killed in that explosion?
No. As far as I know, there were only two of us wounded, and I got the worst of it. The other guy was okay, pretty much.
You described this moment, and I forgive me, I don't remember what the interval of time was, when you heard a nurse refer to you as the burn.
Oh, that was...
Was that much later?
Well, it depends on what much later. I mean, in terms of a couple of months.
Was it a couple of months in?
It was at least a month in, yeah, a month at least, 6 weeks.
I jump a little bit ahead there because I wondered, when did you realize how serious this was? I'm sure you did sooner than that. But
not much, not that much sooner. In fact, I didn't even, when we get to that, it wasn't even quite then. Hmm. But, you know, you just, I really thought I was going to be okay. I mean, I had bandages all over my head. But I said, hey, like, when you take the bandages off, I want to see what I look like. Well, the doctor said, okay. Well, they did. They took the bandages off. And aside from the fact that my face was very raw, looked like actually, you know, really, you know, premium steak, right? It looked like that. All my features were intact. My nose looked like my nose. My mouth looked like my nose.
And you could see okay.
And I could see perfectly. I could hear perfectly. And so, you know, I thought, well, you know, this isn't great, but I mean, as soon as my skin grows back, you know, I'm going to be fine. Well, there was a misconception there on my part because my skin wasn't going to grow back. And of course, it never did because there were third degree burns, and that means, you know, the end of true skin. But, you know, but even then I didn't, you know, so I was thinking I was going to be okay. And then there would be people coming up to me and saying, you know, like nurses or doctors, and they say, hey, you know, Lieutenant, they're doing such great stuff with reconstructive surgery these days. And I said, huh? And another guy would come back and tell me again, so, you know, go through the same thing. Reconstructive surgery, it's terrific. And I thought, what? What the hell are they talking about?
So they would talk this way instead of leveling straight with you about...
No, they were saying I had no idea reconstructive surgery was in my future.
Was it going to be needed?
Yeah, I mean, I thought reconstructive surgery. I mean, Christ, I'm not a Nazi war criminal that has to have my features, you know, fixed so I can go to ground in Paraguay or someplace like that. And then I started to realize that something was going on that I hadn't expected, which was scarring and that pulling and the twisting of the of my face. That's, you know, that happened.
Where were you when you heard that word, where's the burn?
You know, I was being transferred from the station hospital at Da Nang for a brief stopover at Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines on my way to a rather extended stay in an Army hospital in Yokohama, which was the military burn center for the Far East. Yeah, so that's
an important moment for you when you heard that word, that phrase.
Yeah, it was. If anything, you know, ratified the idea that this was worse than I thought, that was probably it.
I wanted to stop for a moment here and go back a little bit before the Amtrak went over the landmine, and your months in Vietnam and your preparations to go to Vietnam when you were in California. What did you understand about Vietnam when you think back? You know so much more now. There's been history books written about it. It's 40 something years ago, but at the time, like in 1965, 1964, what did you think we were trying to accomplish in Vietnam?
What did I think we were trying to accomplish?
Yeah. Did you understand it? Yeah.
Well, I thought I did, and I mean, I think we were trying to do what we said. Some people said we were trying to do. We just weren't doing it very well. And I'm not sure, in fact, that we should have been doing it at all. But what we were trying to do, as I understood it, was to help the South Vietnamese government, which was a friendly government, defend itself against a guerrilla force that were thought to be communists. They called the Viet Cong. And in fact, they were communists. They were also nationalists. And there's a pretty good argument that they basically wanted their country back. And
when you say, I'm not sure we should have been doing it, you add that.
Yeah.
Was that a thought you had in 1964 or 65?
No, it wasn't. It was, and, you know, I wasn't all that politically aware. I mean, I wasn't unaware, but I also knew I was going. I knew I was going to Vietnam, and I knew I was going as an infantry officer. And so I knew it didn't seem to me to be a very valuable thing for me to be trying to figure out the ins and outs of why we were going, you know, and just...
It was more important to stay alive from day to day and carry out the mission. What was in the months, in the months that you were in Vietnam? What was the mission of your unit?
Our unit was, we were an anti-tank battalion, which was, to my great chagrin, I as an infantry officer wound up in that, an anti-tank battalion as opposed to an infantry battalion, but. You know, so what are, and I believe that happened because my name alphabetically was near the bottom of the list of guys coming out of the basic school.
You think that's why it happened?
Yeah, I can't imagine any other reason.
You saw yourself as a leader of a rifle platoon.
Yeah.
Right? You didn't want to be with it.
No.
And did the Viet Cong have tanks?
No, that's the thing. I mean, Viet Cong didn't even have tanks. They didn't have, I'm not even sure they had Jeeps, to tell you the truth. But we did have a mission, which... It was a secondary mission, but it was an important mission, which was to provide protection for convoys who were resupplying troops in the field. And we also, on operations, infantry operations, we provided supporting fire. I mean, our Antos may have looked like, you know, iron roaches, but they had six cannon on them that could... You know, they could certainly take out a tank, and they could take out a good part of the top of a hill, too.
Bob Timberg just used a Greek word, O-N-T-O-S, which means thing.
The thing.
That was this anti-tank.
We had one weapon of consequence, and that was Antos. We had, like, you know, six Antos or four, I can't even remember now. But an Antos looked like a little tank. But it had six 106-millimeter recoilless rifles sticking out of it, and I swear it looked like a roach.
Right.
It looked like a big roach, and so that's, you know, it wasn't cute at all.
Bob Timberg is our guest in this hour of the show. His book, Blue Eyed Boy, a memoir published by Penguin Press. 35 operations. And I don't think I had an appreciation of that either, knowing you all these years, that the number was so high, so many. And over what duration, Bob? How long a period of time was that?
Well, it started in, you know, shortly after I was wounded, which was in January of 67, right? 67. Mm-hmm. And then I had a series of operations, both in Da Nang and then in Yokohama, the Japanese in Japan, and then I was airlifted back to San Diego Naval Hospital, where I, through no fault of my own, had the great good luck of finding one of the great plastic surgeons in the country, who was a naval officer then, and he did a. He must have done 10, 15 operations on me during that period from, like, I don't know, June of 67 to the fall of 68.
This was Lynn Ketchum.
Lynn Ketchum, right. And we became friends too. But then he said, "Hey, Bob, I'm going to discharge you." And I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "I'm going to discharge you. You know, we've done a lot of operations. Your skin has to heal a bit. You know, we can't do any more right now. So, and there's no reason to keep you in the hospital." And, you know, it scared the hell out of me because the hospital had become my haven. I was, you know, I had no desire to be, I mean, I would go home for between operations and everything, but, I mean, he was saying, go home and, you know, do something. And
do something with your life.
Yeah, yeah. And I had no,
wow.
I had no idea what he was talking about. To get back to the number of operations, I can go back to that later if you don't
okay.
mind.
Okay.
I had to come up with something, and I didn't have any great ideas. I had some medium good ideas.
But your wife at the time was Janie,
yeah,
who was from Baltimore originally,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah.
She had a good idea. Turned out to be a good idea. She said, "You know, your letters home were very well written. She thought you were a good writer."
Yeah, and she said, "What about journalism?" And I said, "Janie, let's be serious here. You know, first of all, journalism, just because I write good love letters doesn't mean I can be a journalist. And also, I've never had a word printed anywhere, not grammar school, not high school, not anywhere. And, you know, I had to do something. And so I went through all these different things, and this, that. And it got to the point where if I didn't do anything, you know, I was going to miss graduate school applications. And I would be sitting home doing nothing but feeling sorry for myself and drinking, which I had started doing already anyway. So, you know, we get close to these time to do grad school applications. She says, "What about journalism? You know, think about that again." And I said, "Janie, look. I am not going to go out. You know what people look, how they look at me. I'm not going to go out and run up to them with a little notebook in my hand and a pen and say, 'Hi, I'm Bob Timberg. I want you to tell me this, that, and the other.' I said, I'm not going to do it."
You thought you would scare people.
Yeah. And she said, "Okay." But, you know, the next day I was still scrambling and trying to come up with something. And she said, "I think you should think of journalism again. You could, all those things you're saying you think you'd like to do, if you're a journalist, you could write about all of them." And suddenly it seemed to make some sort of crazy sense. And, you know, it was like I took a dart and took a shot and it landed on journalism. And that's, next thing I knew, I was in Stanford at graduate school in journalism.
Bob Timberg is our guest. We're going to take another little break here on Midday and come back and talk some more about him. Bob's memoir is Blue-Eyed Boy. More with him when we get back. A short break. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here. Our longtime listeners may be familiar with Bob Timberg's byline from The Sun and The Evening Sun in the old days. Before that, he covered the City Hall, the State House in Annapolis, before moving on to the Washington Bureau of the Evening Sun, and then went away and had a Nieman Fellowship at Harvard, came back and was in the Washington Bureau of the Baltimore Sun. And he's written, this is your fourth book, Blue-Eyed Boy.
It is, right.
Your memoir, the one that your son Craig sort of bullied you into writing, finally.
Yes.
You really didn't want to write it?
I didn't want to write it, but as Craig bullied me, I began to see that this made more sense than it ever had it before. I mean, I felt, you know, who really needs another? Who needs another book about, you know, a wounded veteran?
Right.
I mean, I wasn't sure I could do it as well as others had done it, but then I thought, hey, you know, this period is beginning to look familiar to me.
You mean the period we're in now?
The period we're in now.
Oh, yeah.
And then I thought, well, you know, there's one thing that if I tell my story and I tell it well, I think one of the things it will do is illuminate the cost, the price of war for the American public. And, you know, they will understand what it means when, you know, when people go to war. But the other thing, the more compelling issue was, it seemed to me that my story could help some of those kids coming back who have lost their legs or lost an arm or lost their eyesight or lost skin, and, you know, maybe make them realize that it's not over. I mean, for a time, I thought it was over. I thought my life was over, and it wasn't. And I think my story would help, would show them, you know, with a little luck and a little grit and a finding something that matters to you, you know, that you can, you know, you can make a life that, you know, it may not be what you expected it to be, but it could be maybe not that far off kilter. It could be, as, you know, a phrase my son came up with, you know, authentically my own and authentically their own.
To go back to the chronology a little bit, I was curious, another question I've always wanted to ask you, what was it like being on a college campus when, you know, the Vietnam War was still on and there were growing protests in the country, the country becoming more divided over that, Lyndon Johnson announcing he wasn't going to run for president again in 1968?
The thing that was hardest about being on campus at Stanford in that way, and it was something that actually wasn't confined to Stanford or even colleges, what was hard for me to understand, and frankly what was very hard for people of my generation who served in Vietnam, what made it was difficult to understand, was how could members of our generation, you know, refuse, you know, do all sorts of things, you know, get all sorts of phony, you know, phony excuses and
deferments.
Phony deferments and everything. And, you know, they, I mean, it was like, you know, there were doctors, lawyers, all of them were helping out to keep guys out of the service. And, you know, I thought, well, you know, not everybody's doing that. How do these people feel when they see the kid next door who doesn't have the money or the wherewithal to get one of these fancy lawyers to give him a good excuse to not go into the service? I mean, how do you feel? When you watch the kid next door go off to war and you know that you're just sitting home and fake your way out of it, that was what I thought about a lot of the people I saw on the Stanford campus, you know, playing Frisbee or talking about going to grad school.
Right.
And, you know, my feeling was probably a little more intellectual than a lot of other members of my generation. I mean, we, you know, it was, I have a fellow friend of mine who probably said it more concisely than anything I could ever say. He said, I mean, talking about the difference, he said, there's a wall 5 miles high and 50 miles thick between those of us who went and those who didn't. And that wall is never going to come down. And, you know, I'd like to think that's a little over the top. At the same time, it's not that much over the top.
I've heard similar prose used to describe where we are today with the all-volunteer military, two wars, Iraq, Afghanistan, under President George W. Bush, you know, Americans being asked to sacrifice very little, no draft. Draft is gone. Draft has been gone since Vietnam's 41 years now.
Is it really 41?
It's 1973 was the last draft,
oh,
I believe.
Man,
yeah,
man, that's just...
I had a number in the 1972 draft. Yeah, because I was a senior in high school. Yeah, a pretty low number too.
Good for you.
Number 42.
Really?
But things were de-escalating by then.
Yeah,
you know, Nixon
was
in office by then.
Yeah,
right?
And he was pulling guys out.
But I've heard, you know, I've interviewed a couple authors on this show who've written books about, you know, how a lot of people aren't even asked to consider military service these days. Those who serve are volunteering, right? And doing, you know the record of Iraq and Afghanistan, multiple tours for people,
right?
The reserves being called up. And I wonder, what's your view of all that? When I suggested once in a newspaper column in The Sun that we restore the draft, raise that idea again, got a lot of criticism for even raising the idea. People are really opposed to this idea.
I mean, I think they're not only opposed to it, they're scared that if anybody even, you know, mentions it, it could happen, and God forbid, you know, suddenly, you know, they're caught up in it.
Well, my idea was sort of like mandatory service, public service in some way. You can choose military service if you wish, but there are other ways
public service, right.
There are other ways to serve your country, but it would be mandatory for a couple of years.
Right.
So, and some veterans told me that they didn't want to be around draftees, that when they were in Vietnam and years in Vietnam, these were Vietnam veterans, people your age, said that they didn't like being around draftees because they weren't committed to the war, they weren't committed, and they were hard to manage.
See, I love draftees. I mean, the reason was, I'd never considered myself the greatest Marine officer. I figured it was possible that I could make mistakes, and I did. And, you know, the thing is, when you had a draftee who was only in for a couple of years, he wasn't afraid to come and say, hey, Lieutenant, you know that thing you just told us to do? Yeah, what is it? What is it, Corporal? So that's the dumbest thing. You know, it just doesn't work. You got to realize it's really stupid, sir. And they were right. They that happened, and they were right. And the reason was they didn't have any vested interest. They were getting out. They were not trying to build up a career.
Right.
And, you know, I just love draftees. And not all of them did that, but I never saw one that I thought did not carry their own weight.
There not being a draft, do you think it makes it easier for our nation to casually step into wars?
I think that's...
casually. I shouldn't use the word casually, maybe.
No, but. Well, I think that's right. I think, you know, if it wasn't casual the way we got into Iraq or Afghanistan, and Afghanistan I see is far different, but you know, there wasn't this sense that we really thought this stuff out. You know, it was so. I mean, I basically agree with you. There was a kind of something akin to being casual about that.
It would have been harder to pull off with a draft.
Yeah, I mean, with a draft, you know, what you're doing is you're taking middle class kids who have parents who can scream bloody murder. Not to mention the kids themselves. And this never happened in Vietnam because, you know, at a certain point, you know, the middle-class kids were out, for the most part, protesting.
Right.
But, you know, when you have an all-volunteer force, it gives a president enormous power. I mean, he said, you know, do this, go here, and you really can't argue because, I mean, this is what we signed up for. This is what you signed up for. Just do it.
Back in the chronology of your story, a little bit more from the memoir, Blue-Eyed Boy, Bob, you got a job at the Capitol in Annapolis after grad school, and you were still worried about going out in public.
Absolutely.
And walking up to strangers and asking them for quotes to describe something that happened or something for your news stories. So how did that work out?
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, when I got the job, I just had even applying for the job was kind of not something I wanted to do. But I had all my friends at Stanford in the graduate program and journalism, were all applying for jobs, and I got caught up in their momentum, and I applied for a job without actually wanting a job. Well, I got a job.
And back in Annapolis.
Back in Annapolis. It was then the Annapolis Evening Capital, is now the Annapolis Capital. And, you know, I couldn't type to begin with. I didn't even know how to type. I had never had a word anywhere. And there I was sitting at a desk like a real reporter, and over to my right, behind a big desk, is a city editor who I barely knew. I mean, I knew the big editor, but not the city editor, who was, in fact, like the real guy that commanded the troops.
He's a dispatcher.
Yeah.
Sends you out on assignments.
Yeah. But more than a dispatcher, he's like the CEO, you know. he was like the company commander. The other guys were like up there in the stratosphere somewhere. Right. And, you know, I'm just sitting there wondering what the hell's going to happen. And he says, hey, there. He picks up the phone and he listens and he says something, slams down the phone and says, some woman is threatening to jump off the Spa Creek Bridge.
In Annapolis.
In Annapolis, yeah. And I looked over at him, and he was looking at me. Like, was he talking to me, or was he talking to everybody? You know, me? And he said, Timberg, go. And...
So you went to cover the story.
I went to cover the story. I took a notebook and a pen, and I went out to do what I was always afraid to do. But the thing was, I was still afraid. But what I was afraid of most was not getting the story, which, you know, may say something about me that, you know. And I got down there. I mean, I had to run all the way down to the bridge. And you know how it was like over. Whatever had been going on was over. And I went up to a cop and I said, can you tell me what happened? And he said, no, I can't talk to you. I said, well, come on, you can't talk to me. He said, no, I can't. You talk to that guy over there. I said, all right, listen. This is my first story, my first job. Just give me a hint. Tell me what happened. So he says, okay, a lady jumped off the bridge and she killed herself and they just fished her out. And I said, ugh. I said, okay, now I know what I got to deal with. But I got to get the story. I got to know what happened. And at that point, with a little bit of information, I went around to everybody who was standing around, the onlookers, the firemen, the emergency medical people. And, I mean, I talked to anything that moved.
They all talked to you?
Yeah, they all talked to me.
And no one was shocked to look at you? Or?
I don't know.
You didn't even think about that.
I didn't care.
I just didn't have time.
They just had to tell me. You know, if they had been making faces at me, as long as they're saying, yeah, but this is what happened. This lady went to. And so, you know, I didn't realize it at the time, but I had talked to enough people. I went back to the office, wrote the story, and the next day, you know, on the front page of the Annapolis Evening Capital, I had this story about this lady who leaped off the bridge, crashed through the ice, and died.
And from then on,
I'm
sure people stared at you over the years, but from that day on,
I realized after that happened, hey, you know, I don't feel disfigured. I am disfigured, but I don't feel that way. And, you know, I've never said this to anybody before, but over the years, I think I've been getting younger. And these days, I think of myself as 26. And when I talk to people, I don't feel disfigured. I'm not a fool. I know I am.
Right.
But you know,
you lived your life.
Yeah.
You had a pretty good career too, Bob.
Ain't over yet.
It ain't over yet. For the time being, this is Bob Timberg's fourth book. We'll see about the fifth one. This one is called Blue Eyed Boy. And, Bob, it's been great to have you on the show again to talk about your memoir. I'm glad you finally got it done. And it's gripping reading. It's really a great read. Congratulations again.
Thank you, Dan. And I'm not planning to write another book, but if I do, one of the reasons I'll do it is so we can do this again. Okay. It's so much fun.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you. And thank you, everyone, for tuning into our first hour today of Midday. I hope you enjoyed the hour. We're going to take a break now for lunch. Brought to us by Atwaters. Atwaters supports local radio, local farmers, and local appetites. Located locally at Belvedere Square, the shops at Kenilworth, Bear Hills, or Main Street, Catonsville. Visit atwaters.biz for more information. We'll see you on the other side of the news for the second hour of our show.